This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Hey, what really matters to us, as you know from Matt, when he woke up this morning and is, you know, and put on his like little banana slip, not banana slippers.
Because I'm getting so old, I have to put on glasses. Didn't happen before I was like 47, but now macular degeneration is taking over.
Puts on the glasses, puts on the bunny slippers, and then picks up his phone and reads about Bloomberg. This Bloomberg exclusive with the most listened to big bank CEO, Jamie Dimon, who, yes, talked about a lot of the big macro stories of the day. The thing we all really seem to care about is Dimon hinting about life after J.P. Morgan, President Dimon, perhaps. Here's Jamie earlier today on Bloomberg TV from J.P. Morgan's annual Global China Summit in Shanghai. Dimon, of course, talking with our Bloomberg team, specifically Stephen Engel.
Now, Jamie, I know last week you talked a lot about succession or about your position, that you're not talking about retirement right now. I do need to ask you, though, and your name has been bandied about for years about public office. I mean, I don't think Wall Street's too pleased about a potential Trump versus Biden runoff next year. Is it any, has that scenario ever crossed your mind that you would run for public office or even accept a cabinet position?
You know, obviously it's crossed my mind because people mention things to you and stuff like that. You know, I love my country and maybe one day I'll serve my country in one capacity or another, but I love what I do. I think J.P. Morgan do a great job for helping Americans, for helping countries around the world, and this is my job. This is what I'm going to do, and I'm quite happy doing it. I still have the energy to do it. I mentioned, you know, that when you don't, I think people should give up the job. We've got a fabulous management team who I really enjoy working with, I'm here.
Here for now. Jamie Dimon, of course, with our Bloomberg News, Stephen Engel at the Global China Summit in Shanghai.
I think Bloomberg News is okay.
That was like so bad. Oh, trying to rush to get to Allison Williams. Let's get into it with Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Global Banks Analyst Allison Williams with us on Zoom in New Jersey. Allison, thanks for joining Matt and me. Gosh, we can't talk enough about this story. How do you see it? Should we assume potentially that Jamie Dimon might be, for now, really considering maybe a run into politics?
I mean, I think, as he said in the interview, and he also said at Investor Day, he loves running the company. That's obvious.
He always says that. That's good that the CEO of J.P. Morgan likes
that,
his
right?
job. That's fantastic. I mean, if you pay me that much money, I'll like any job you give me.
Right, but he makes a point that, you know, he does not see him in his future sitting around and playing golf. That's just not who he is. He also talked about the love of his country, and if you read his annual letters, he always has definite views, not just in terms of bank regulation, but thoughts broadly. And you know, the interview earlier where he, you know, spoke globally about the economy, about China, and different things. So he definitely has views. He obviously is a strong leader, and he did leave the door open. President, I think we all like to think about that. Is there potentially another role? We can look at what other former CEOs have done, like Hank Paulson. You know, could there be something in Treasury or something else in government?
It does seem like he's talking about serving his country, and there are a number of ways he could do that other than as president. Treasury Secretary is the most obvious.
But he would take the top spot.
For a guy from Wall Street. But exactly. Allison, you've been covering Jamie Dimon. How long has he been running J.P. Morgan? Since 2006? I'm sure you've been covering him since long before that. Would this guy really take a less senior role than president in the United States government?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define senior. I mean, head of Treasury is what I think considered by many to be a senior role. Certainly, president is a much broader role. And I think he has thought about it in the past. But and so I think there are different options that he might consider.
So I have a question. If he didn't go for the top spot, although I agree that that's where he'd go, Allison, if he, let's say, would be Treasury Secretary, could he be a Treasury Secretary under a Democrat or a Republican potentially?
I think that he has sort of at least indicated some of his political views. I think that as long as he, most important for him would be to get things done according to his beliefs. So that could certainly be an influence.
Wait, what in terms that? Of what does that mean? Wait, help me out there. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Commit, Allison. Just take a stand.
Well, I guess I'm just saying that, you know, under prior leadership of this country, I think he has voiced opinions that were not in sync with that prior leadership. And so that could influence who he might want to serve under.
Okay.
So it sounds like he could actually, I get it. I get what you're saying.
I just wonder if he would. Now, obviously, this is very speculative. And
it's what we love to do here.
I just think because of the stature of Jamie Dimon on Wall Street and because of the political setup that we have now where it seems like every candidate is one that nobody really wants to vote for. It would be interesting to have an outsider. You know, I talked to Ross Perot Jr. earlier, yeah. And I said this kind of reminded me of his dad running, not because Jamie Dimon and Ross Perot are similar, but because it's a billionaire from another industry who's like a titan of his industry, and now he's stepping into the political ring.
It's not unheard of.
At a time when it needed a little bit of shaking up. I just think it would be fascinating. I can understand why you're a little hesitant to speculate with us, Allison, but do you think he would run as a Democrat or a Republican?
I think, I guess I would just allude to what you were saying before in terms of, we have a leader, right? That was in business, yep. And has switched parties. So I guess that's what I'm alluding to. I think it would be more important for Jamie to run along the lines, regardless of the party, he would want to run along the lines of the principles that he believes in. So I can say Bloomberg, right, who owns our company and ran for office successfully as mayor and did switch parties because he just believed in a set of principles that he wanted to guide to. And I think most important to Jamie will be would be leading towards those guiding principles. I think what would be tough for him in government and what's been tough for other bank CEOs that have gone into higher positions in the federal government has been getting things done. And Jamie is definitely someone who is extremely hands-on, likes getting things done. And I think that it would be the thing that would be tougher.
And I also think he's not going to run unless he knows he's going to win. Like, he's just that kind of an individual. And
yeah,
I don't know that.
The money?
Well, yeah, but among other, Hey, the reason we are obsessed with it, Allison, as you know, it is the third most read story on the Bloomberg in the past 8 hours. So thanks for playing along with us. Having said that, what was very significant is about Jamie Dimon, the presence, the company, holding this event in China at a time when politically the tensions are pretty difficult, or so it seems at least. What's the most significant thing you got from Jamie and his comments out of China today?
Most significant, I think, as it pertains to China, is just the long-term commitment despite the difficulties and despite the added complexities that JP Morgan is committed. And I think that is something that for business, for banks, but businesses in general, in order to be successful over the long term, you do have to retain that commitment. And I think the fact that he is saying that it is difficult, but they will manage through those difficulties. Also just talking about the fact that seeing less trade, but not a decoupling. And I think that's important for JP Morgan as a significant global bank, the most significant global investment bank, and also a leading global asset manager.
How much would it hurt them at decoupling? How much would that hurt JP Morgan's, you know, revenue?
I mean, I think it, you know, there, I wouldn't point to, I guess, a specific thing, right? But those businesses are global businesses. Some of the, to the extent that it hurts the economy, that's the biggest, I guess, indirect impact, right, if you would. But they do serve multiple, they do serve multinational corporations that have operations around the world. So in terms of a direct customer benefit, wherever those companies are operating, I would imagine they would likely support in those huge capital markets businesses. They're not sort of an on-the-ground retail lender, like someone like Citigroup, which yeah. is a strategy that only Citigroup and HSBC have been successful, and even those banks have sort of pulled back from that. So from a direct impact, perhaps less.
Allison Williams of our BI team, thank you so much. Shares of JP Morgan down about 1.4%. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Right now, though, we want to talk about stuff going on outside the United States, specifically what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. The U.S. and European allies urging caution on whether Ukraine should have the right to strike inside Russia, that amid concerns that a potential escalation could drag them into a broader war. Meantime, you've got President Putin demanding that Russia strengthen air defenses around Moscow after the biggest drone attack on the capital since he ordered the invasion of Ukraine. So let's get the latest and some really thoughtful thinking about the what's going on, at least the latest incidents. A valued voice for us on the war is Angela Stemp. She's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council, also served in the Office of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State, and her 2019 book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. She joins us once again on the phone from Washington, D.C. Angela, good to check in with you once again. We've been wanting to since those headlines about the drone attack in Moscow specifically. What do you think about what's going on right now, this war that's been going on for more than a year? What do you think is going on inside the mind of President Putin right now?
So President Putin knows that the Ukrainians have said that they're going to launch a counteroffensive anytime soon. They've been saying that for some time, but we believe they will do that. And so he's clearly very concerned about that. Then you had a few weeks ago, a lone drone attack right inside the Kremlin walls. And then yesterday you had these drones that attacked the very posh suburb of Moscow, where all the wealthy people live and where Putin himself has one of his official residences. So he must be wondering what the Ukrainians or their supporters have up their sleeves next. I mean, the Ukrainians have said that they didn't launch the drones yesterday. We do know that there are also saboteurs inside Russia. A few days ago, and it's going on now, we had a group of people who identify themselves as anti-Putin Russians march over the border to Belgorod. And today, the Russians are evacuating children from that border town. So it's really to give the Russians a dose of their own medicine and make them uneasy and not know what's coming in the future. But it must make Putin very angry about this. This, remember, was supposed to be a 3-day war.
So before we go any further with the drone attacks on the Kremlin, I've got to ask you, Angela, about what everyone says when I talk about this. And that is, well, who did the Nord Stream pipeline attack, right? It doesn't make any sense that the Russians would have sabotaged their own pipeline, but also the U.S. doesn't typically operate that way. It wasn't a fantastic job. So who do you think was behind that?
I mean, who knows? There's so much mystery surrounding all of this. I've seen reports in the press here that some governments think that it was a group of Ukrainians or pro-Ukrainians, not government-sponsored, but if you like, they were freelancing, that they did that. I don't know whether we'll ever know who did it, but I don't really have any good theories. I mean, if you think the Russians did it, the only reason would be to raise, you know, oil and natural gas prices, but that seems a rather roundabout way of doing it. So I think we don't know now.
As you said, we thought this was going to be a 3-day war. Here we are, you know, 1 year and counting. So
they thought it was going to be a 3-day war.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And I think the world thought that this was going to come to an end much more quickly. Having said that, how do you figure out or how do you think about when this might come to an end and what might ultimately bring it to an end?
Well, at the moment, there really does seem to be no end in sight. I think Putin definitely believes that he can outlast the West, that eventually, you know, we'll have elections in the U.S. next year. There are other European countries that will have elections. And in the end, people will say, you know, we can't go on supporting Ukraine like this. We're dealing with inflation. And so we should really rethink that. So that's what he's waiting for. He's waiting for the West to give up on Ukraine, if you like. And then the Ukrainians won't have all those weapons. And so eventually they won't have any choice but to negotiate with Russia on Russia's terms. Now, so far, we haven't seen that happening. The West is still pretty united.
Pretty united.
15 months into it, yeah.
I mean, Angela, we're starting to see, especially on the far right, grumblings about why are we funding this war, or at least why are we funding the defense of this democratic nation? Do you think that's going to go further? Does it seem like those in, you know, the Freedom Caucus are going to try and take funding away?
Oh, I'm sure that they will. I mean, so far, I think we have very robust congressional support for Ukraine, mostly. But the people in the Freedom Caucus, the people who are supporters of Donald Trump, think that we shouldn't be supporting Ukraine. Some of those people even think that Russia should be our ally, not Ukraine. And I'm sure as we get into the election season for next year, those voices are going to get louder. And the people who still believe in supporting Ukraine are going to have to come up with very convincing arguments.
What about the people of Russia more broadly? Are they still behind him? We know that there are factions, right, of folks that don't support it. But I'm just curious more broadly, especially if, you know, you now see, you know, the drone attack on Moscow. Is that changing sentiment internally?
Well, I think for those people who believe in the government narrative, then, you know, the drones just shows that it's the aggressive West. So the majority of Russians still appear at least to support this war passively because they have been fed this diet of propaganda that the West and the U.S. is out to get them. Then there are groups in Russia who think that Putin isn't being strict enough with this war, that the Russia should be more extreme in the way that it's treating Ukraine. So he gets criticism from the right as well. But so far, there does not seem to be any kind of a groundswell movement in Russia that's anti-war. Don't forget, 1 million people have already left Russia, many of whom left because they opposed the war.
All right. So in terms of the war on the ground in Ukraine, what are the chances that the Ukrainians can actually make some headway and push the Russians out? Is that even in the cards, or do they need jets and a lot more from the West to do it?
Well, I think people believe that they may be able to push the Russians out of some of the occupied areas in this counteroffensive. But this is only going to be one of what apparently will be a number of different counteroffensives. I don't think anybody thinks for this particular one that will happen soon that they're going to push the Russians out of everything that they occupied, particularly the territories that they already occupied after 2014.
So how do you think about this? I mean, I think I've talked with you before, you know, writing another book and how you're thinking about, you know, Putin going forward in Russia. I'm not wrong. But so, like, how are you thinking about this?
Well, I'm still looking into what I think will be a very long war. Mm. This could go on for a long time, as long as Ukraine gets weapons from the West, because the Russians will get what they need, even if the army has performed certainly below par. At some point, the Russians might be persuaded that it's in their interest to have a ceasefire. But so far, they've said that they will only do that if Ukraine accepts all their conditions. And as long as Ukraine is fighting back and as long as it's led by Volodymyr Zelensky, they're not going to do that.
Hey, Angela, who watches this the most closely? China, Taiwan? I'm just curious, North Korea? Who do you think is watching this, especially in terms of how the West reacts with Moscow?
Well, clearly China is watching very carefully because it does affect its own view of maybe the timing on what it does to Taiwan. And then I think probably countries like North Korea are watching this too, just to see how this plays out. But I think China is the one for whom this probably has the most resonance.
North Korea. They're watching it on like an old black and white set with rabbit ears.
It's all right. They're watching. Angela, always appreciate you weighing in on this. Be well. Good to check in with Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Check out her world and her book that's on Putin's world, Russia Against the West and with the Rest, as we said, you know, has served within the U.S. Department of State and the National Intelligence Council. So really has some great vantage point on Putin himself, but just more broadly when it comes to global policy.
And really not a lot of reason for optimism here, right? As she said, it looks like a war that's going to go on a long time. The Ukrainians don't seem to have the power to push the Russians out. And we know that the Russians have talked about using tactical nukes. So this could be something that goes on for longer and could be a lot more destruction.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Hey, I don't know if you saw this data. Home prices up for a second straight month. Buyers coming back to the market, competing over a few homes for sale. The median sale price of a new home dropping around a little bit more than 8% from a year earlier, $420,800, marking the biggest decline since April 2020 and reflecting more purchases of cheaper homes. So the price though, Matt, bottom line, I guess what I wanted to say just quickly is that it's still beyond the reach for many.
Well, yes. I mean, and if they're moving at all, I think that's interesting, right? Because the problem in the residential housing market has been the buyers can't afford not only the price, but when you throw in the rates, mortgage rates, it puts it way out of the reach of many. And then the sellers aren't willing to drop the price enough to make it affordable. So you haven't been seeing a lot of traffic there.
No, exactly. So let's get to it, though, because our next guest certainly has a great view when it comes to housing. Brendan McCluskey is principal at Trident Builders, joining us on Zoom in Baltimore. Bloomberg Philanthropies, by the way, the philanthropic arm of Bloomberg LP, parent of Bloomberg Media, is providing some support for Trident's efforts. Brendan, nice to have you back and joining Matt and me on this Wednesday. Hey, tell us a little bit about the work that you have been doing and remind our audience and kind of where you are in the process.
Hi, Carol and Matt. So it was great. We caught up about in what, July of last year when I was at the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Summit down in Washington, D.C. At the time, we were actually just starting to push dirt at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, which is just south of Annapolis, Maryland. We were building what were to be 6 passive house cottages. So basically, as close to net zero energy consuming cottages and dwelling units as possible. Since then, we've completed the project, and we really kind of blew it out of the water what the performance requirements are. You know, the final product of what we delivered there, the houses actually produce 200% of the power they consume day or night.
So more than they actually need, right?
Correct. And they're actually exporting net clean energy at the peak energy load times of the day. So those hottest days in the summertime when all of our air conditioners are working full throttle, that's when they're producing the most clean energy.
It's interesting. Go on.
No, I was going to say, I want to turn it over to you.
It's interesting that, you know, we talk to builders all the time, and every Everyone, without exception, over the last, let's say, year and a half, is building homes for the wealthy, you know, or McMansions, as Paul Sweeney likes to call them. And affordable housing is just not there. How does that get solved?
No, it's a great question. You know, basically the market has been disincentivized to focus on entry-level housing, even for middle-class people. Really, it's only the ultra-wealthy that they get the biggest bang in the buck in return. You know, what we saw as a real, I guess, innovation in the approach was the adoption of modularized, panelized construction. So don't think of this as a trailer. Basically, the same wall panel and configuration of a house can be done, but to a much greater quality in a factory setting. So the quality control and the productivity cost of a factory setting can be applied to the construction industry, which allows us to lower our costs if we're able to do it at scale. And I think that's where we see a real market opportunity in focusing on lower income housing, especially in blighted neighborhoods of Baltimore.
Hang on. Brendan, so the cost of this, I mean, is it expensive? Ultimately, what's the financial equation with all of this in terms of what you guys are doing? Obviously, we love kind of the clean energy report, you know, aspect of it. But is it cost a lot more than regular building?
Well, it's just like a factory, right? So, you know, think of a building a single Ferrari in a Ferrari factory versus what Ford does with F-150s. You know, the first couple of units, yeah, are more expensive on a per unit basis. But you start to meet equilibrium between one and the other around 60 to 70 units. And once you start talking north of 100, each unit cost goes down. So basically all your soft costs in terms of design, architecture, and whatnot get spread across the various projects. And then you're also able to streamline the permitting process and the delivery process. You know, we are versus conventional renovation of a 100-year-old a row home in Baltimore that's falling apart and is covered with lead and asbestos. We're able to do it at price parity, but we're able to do it in about half the time.
And that's
really where the cost savings are.
And that's what the cost to put up the new structure, right? Does that include the cost of taking down the old structure and getting rid of it?
Well, so the beautiful thing is we're starting out with places where they've already taken down the old structures. So there's a lot of inventory underneath Larry Hogan and as well as now Wes Moore. You know, a lot of these blighted properties that are vacants and are burnt out, you know, they're knocking them over and they're just creating open vacant lots. So, you know, the easiest item apple to pick off is the one that's on the ground. And like, those are the ones we're going after.
Listen, I think this is so cool. And I always think about building overall, you know, how can it be more efficient? How can it be better for the environment? How do you think about it? You know, Brendan, I love the mission that you guys are doing specifically in terms of affordable housing. But how do we think about it in terms of scaling it up?
Well, so that was actually the big epiphany I had about a month and a half ago. So when we last talked, I was trying to do this as a vertically integrated developer builder. I was trying to, you know, do soup to nuts the entire thing. But it dawned on me that it was taking me an awful lot of time and energy. And honestly, I was just like, felt like I was talking to a wall sometimes when it came to the city. That all of a sudden, it dawned on me that there are literally dozens of small urban size scale developers that are very much committed to these communities. And they don't want to see them gentrify. They want to see equity built within those communities. It dawned on me that I've got a customer pool. And it was really kind of interesting. I had a conversation with a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Business. And we more or less convened a meeting a week ago on Monday. And over the course of that meeting, you know, it was really just an exploratory kind of conversation. And, you know, about an hour into it, you know, we all determined, like, okay, yeah, this is happening. We're going to form a co-op. And so all of these small urban developers are going to start teaming up together. And frankly, they're going to allow me to build the pipeline and arrange them in a sequential order for us to, you know, assign spots within production runs at the factory and get all their permitting and all of like the approvals in place. And so we can literally just steamroll all these various neighborhoods across the city in a orderly and planned manner.
That's very cool. So you team up with a bunch of other smaller developers into an organization and your factory produces the housing that they can put into their own individual communities.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, to be kind of crazy about it, it's like all of us builders are looking for that next $20 to $30 million a year customer. And I kind of invented one.
It's really fascinating. Well, listen, I'm so glad we got to check back in with you. Come back in a few months and let us know how it's all going. It's just great to get an update. Brendan, be well. Brendan Miskolcki, he is president of Trident Builders on Zoom from Baltimore. Very cool.
Yeah, very cool indeed. And
affordable housing,
it's
important
a solution that this country really needs right now, because nothing's affordable, but housing is just off the charts expensive.
Yeah, it's out of reach for so many Americans. All right, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Matt Miller. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Masser and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we are waiting for lawmakers to come together. As we mentioned, that there is an important vote coming up in the House later on today. So lawmakers, we know, continuing to work through that debt ceiling deal. Bloomberg's Enda Curran taking a look, though, at its economic impact or lack thereof on the U.S. economy and really overall U.S. debt. The story you can find online at BloombergBusinessWeek.com and also on the Bloomberg terminal. So let's get to it. Bloomberg News global economy reporter Enda Curran on Zoom in our D.C. bureau. Also with us is the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. You know, it's really funny, Joel. We have so many conversations in the narrative of, you know, concerned about the U.S. fiscal, you know, situation, the debt ceiling negotiations, you know, but what we really ultimately care about is what's the impact on the U.S. economy.
Yeah, and for that, we turn to Enda. And, you know, one of the things that has been crazy about this was just how, and I should say, continues to be crazy because we're not totally out of the woods here. But as we've been talking about this, the impact on the economy is sort of that big question. And like, could it, you know, could the outcome here tip us into recession if it doesn't go the right way? So talk to us about that, Enda. What did you lay out in your story?
Yeah, so that was the big question. What kind of spending cuts might come out of it? And would it be enough to tip the U.S. into recession? As you know, that's been such a line ball call. Well, the answer seems to be that this is something of a nothing burger. There's been so much rhetoric around it in terms of it being the biggest sort of material adjustment in government spending in years by the Republican side. And of course, Democrats defending their interests. But the economists who look at this say it's pretty modest. Some have said it's just full of gimmicks, so to speak. And in terms of the net effect on actual spending and actual growth, it's negligible in terms of whether or not it's going to push the economy into a recession over the near term. I mean, there are adjustments around, for example, some of the COVID spending clawbacks. There are some adjustments to the forbearance and student loans. That will hurt sentiment on the ground, no doubt. Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics, he ran the numbers and he reckons maybe you're talking about 150,000 job losses in terms of where these spending tweaks might come. But, you know, net in the bigger scheme of things, this in of itself isn't considered enough to tip the U.S. into recession.
So the hopes for this legislation, I guess, are twofold. One, we hope that it will somehow reduce the debt that we have and the deficits that we run to bring those carrying costs down. On the other hand, we hope it doesn't hurt the economy too much, right? Because the two things that could affect the economy would affect it in a negative way that you just mentioned, the clawbacks of COVID-19 assistance and forbearance on student debt. When we look back at this 10 years later, and we said, okay, we made that deal when we had 125% debt to GDP. Are we going to say that put us in a better position, only 115%, 110%? Or are we going to say it did nothing and now we're at, you know, 150, 200%?
I don't think this deal is going to do a lot for that trajectory. I mean, if you take the politics out of it, Matt, and we're just objective about it, plenty of analysts are saying the U.S. is borrowing too much money. The trajectory for where it's going is quite worrying. Some estimates of up to maybe 160% of GDP over the next decade or so. This agreement doesn't change any of that. The interest rate costs for the U.S., by the way, Oxford Economics estimating it going up about 40% year on year alone. The IMF are out there saying the U.S. government's going to have to figure out ways to shrink its deficit and make some painful decisions around perhaps health spending and that kind of thing. But this deal doesn't seem to do that. And what people are talking about, though, is it's suspending the debt limit and kicking it down the road until 2025. So what could happen is that this might become a major issue in the presidential election next year. And whoever does win that comes in with a big mandate to change the fiscal trajectory for the U.S. I mean, that's one possibility. But this in and of itself, those kids in elementary school now, 10 years from now, this won't have done much for them.
We've been, you know, have you looked at the can lately? Because we've been kicking it for a long time. It's pretty battered. What I wonder, though, Enda, is, you know, the flip side to this is we could grow our way out of it. And that could depend on maybe opening up the borders, allowing more immigration to come in. That is a possible scenario, but it's, you know.
And innovation. I mean, the key to growing your way out of this kind of crisis is always innovation, isn't it?
Well, the biggest key has been inflation, right? You inflate your way out of debt. So that's been very positive for the U.S. debt profile over the past couple of years. But ironically, now you have inflation slowing down. So it's going to make that burden harder to shoulder going forward. But there's no doubt, you're absolutely right, Carolyn. The U.S. economy is in good order right now. In fact, it's obviously stellar compared to its peers around the rest of the world. So there are the prospects there that it can continue to shoulder these servicing costs. Maybe the Fed runs out of steam and brings its hiking cycle to an end soon. Maybe even it starts to trim. That takes pressure off. But all that said, though, the constant narrative around this, and as I say, politics aside, people are saying the spending is unsustainable. There needs to be some very difficult decisions made. And at some point, some administration is going to have to do that to avoid kind of Japan-style fate.
Okay. And you spoke to like a considerable number of people for this story. And I'm just curious, like who's the most interesting person with a sort of a non-traditional take on all of this?
I actually think Goldman Sachs are pretty interesting. They're making the point that this is a big reduction in uncertainty, but like it's that's it, right? It's certainly not a game changer. It's a nothing burger, as I mentioned earlier on, when it comes to the borrowing story for the U.S. Alex Phillips is their political economist here in Washington, and so it's pretty interesting when these banks are coming out with these kind of calls saying that despite all the weeks of drama we've had, and it was real drama, this is a very serious issue, even though it's abstract and might not resonate on the Main Street. But for all of that, the end result is not much. Right, this could have been done at any point over the past 6 months. They could have come to the table, agreed their tweaks among each other that suits their constituencies, and moved on. But instead, that would have
been so boring, right? You have to have some fireworks and theatrics, and you know, get people fired up if you're, you know, appealing to an electorate. So, is this just business as usual, and like we're always going to have this drama in D.C. over anything debt ceiling related?
Well, you know, this hasn't gone away, right? They've only suspended the debt ceiling. And as I'm saying to you, I think this could become possibly an issue in next year's U.S. presidential election. If the candidates choose to make it so, it could become a real choice between what kind of government do you want and where do you want your borrowings and spending to go. But by the way, along the way, I think, as we've discussed before, I think it has been damaging. You saw the credit rating warning mm-hmm. that came out from yep. Fitch during this process. None of that would have happened if this process played out the way it did.
Hey, what about debt servicing? I always think about that.
I was just going to ask the same question.
That's scary that you and I are
thinking alike. How expensive is it? Is it really unsustainable, Enda?
So it's not unsustainable as long as the government is growing the economy, as you mentioned earlier, and you know, people are in work and everyone's able to service their mortgages across the board and the government's able to pay its debt and collect its revenues and all of that. But it's putting a lot of pressure on making sure that everything needs to go right between now and then. And as I say, the figure from Oxford Economics, I think, is that the debt servicing has gone up about 40% year on year. That's a lot that the government's having to spend out when you consider they could be using that money to spend on schools and hospitals instead. So there's no doubt the 5-odd percentage rate of increases, interest rate increase over the past year is having a big impact.
I'm not as great a scholar of all governments, but I'm curious, do other governments, you've been other places around the world for Bloomberg, I mean, do they go through the same wrangling when it comes?
No, this is not normal.
what is it about our system that is just seems to be such a mess?
Well, this is obviously an archaic part of the convention of government in Washington, right? That they have to come to the floor and get this agreement to lift their borrowing ceiling every few years whenever they run into it.
Those lawmakers, right? Lawmakers agree on that spending, and then all of a sudden it's like, wait, we need more money.
And they've been increasing the spending dramatically over recent years, both sides of the political divide, during the pandemic and after. So it kind of come as a surprise that they were going to run out of room eventually. But around the rest of the world, this is a similar story. You look at Japan and the level of debt there. I think it's around 200% of GDP. All of the developed economies around the world are swimming in debt at household, corporate, government level. And of course, in the emerging world, China's debt profile as well is often talked about as a major concern. So it's not just the US, but I think the point is that the US is one of these AAA economies. It's got the world's reserve currency. It's the fulcrum of the global economy. It's the world's biggest economy. So it's not the kind of trajectory that I think people would like to see the US on.
Even if we don't default, isn't it understandable that our credit rating would take a hit? Because people buy this debt, especially foreigners, specifically because it's risk-free, and it doesn't feel terribly risk-free right now.
You know, the way they were flirting with default and even entertaining that idea is just not the optics that you want when you are selling yourself as the ultimate risk-free asset in the world.
Let's not forget, there's still a lot of people in Congress that are talking about the fact that they would prefer to default on this than to default on freedom or whatever they say, right? I mean, mostly they're...
Right, could that be politics, perhaps?
On the very right and the very left.
The theatrics.
But I just wonder, you know, and Business Week obviously had a cover story on the slight decline in the dominance of the dollar. Of course, it's still the world reserve currency, but do we deserve to be AAA? I mean...
Well, S&P cut the U.S. around a decade ago. Remember that in 2011?
Oh, I was here.
Which came as a shock then. Now Fitch has the U.S. on a warning that they may cut them. If Fitch cut them, I think that would be a major knock to the prestige of the U.S. Moody's has been somewhat quiet on all of this. I have seen some of those politicians coming out and make the point that they shouldn't accept this deal. But there's no doubt the IMF as well making the warning last week that the U.S. has got to get its fiscal house in order. You'd have to say it's definitely... playing it pretty, skirting close to the edge, I think, now when it comes to that AAA rating.
A big finger wag from the IMF. So you got to be scared of that one. So what about that recession that we talked about at the top? Like, based on the economists that you got to speak with, what we know about what this deal could look like, is this going to tip us closer or what do we know?
I think people are pushing their forecast for recession out again after this spending agreement. There's no sign of a recession just yet. People don't think this will necessarily be the trigger for it. On paper, you do have fiscal policy and the central bank going now in the same direction, which is basically taking money off the table. That will, you know, crimp things around the margins. But this in and of itself isn't expected to be enough to tip the US into recession. I think it still comes back to what's going to happen with jobs. We'll get jobs numbers on Friday. That's critical. And of course, where does the inflation story go? Because that's where the whole interest rates and borrowing cost story will go. But 6 odd months from now, if US is in recession, I don't think people will be blaming the 99-page Fiscal Responsibility Act.
But it's kind of the story of the year. Like, the recession is out there somewhere.
It's somewhere, but everyone keeps pushing their forecasts out. I'm not sure if Anna Wong still has a 100% chance of recession for the US.
It ain't happened yet. Has it happened yet?
It's out there.
But yeah, I mean, here the Fed, you know, more and more people are talking about two hikes. Larry Fink brought it up today, right? And are you watching for, obviously, a pause? They're telling us they're going to have a pause in June, but another hike in July.
Yeah, well, the inflation numbers last week probably weren't great, especially the core inflation numbers. Services very sticky, which we've written about as well. Law firm, legal costs going through the roof, you know, auto costs going through the roof. So at the very least, there's another Fed hike on the table at some point. It's a question of which month they choose. But it is so interesting, the U.S. economy holding up the way it is despite those rate hikes. Germany, the engine of Europe, has fallen into recession. China's post-COVID rebound has pretty much faded out and is coming back to earth with a big bump. But the U.S. continues to be the standout. The Fed just can't seem to rein in what's going on here.
U.S. job openings surged to 10.1 million. We got that data point today.
I don't know how believable that data is, to be honest. And I don't think that the survey respondents are nearly as numerous as they used to be. It's dropped. I think only 31% survey respondents there. So
phantom job openings, some economists called them, but.
Yeah. Phantom job openings.
Sort of like that recession just out
there. Exactly.
Where is it? I know you're out there. We got to run. Enda, thanks so much. Enda Curran, global economy reporter at Bloomberg News on Zoom from Washington. No, actually, I believe he's in D.C., but I think he's at home. Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, in our studio, our interactive broker studio. Carol Masser, Matt Miller, and this is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, check it out, everybody. Just under 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Carol Masser, along with Matt Miller, live in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals. And Matt, we're definitely off our lows of this session, just down a little bit on the day overall. But feels like we're marking time. And we have the S&P keeping below that 4,200 mark.
Yeah, that's right. So we've given up, I think, all of the gains for May. Sell in May and go away is what they say, you know. So I guess today's your last day to do that.
Jump on board. All right, let's get to it. Our Drive to the Close guest is Anne Mulledy, head of active equity over at Allspring Global Investments, with us on Zoom from Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. Anne, nice to have you back with us. Hey, let's talk about the S&P. We did see it down, I think, more than 1% earlier in the session. So it is still down below 4,200. Little change for the month overall, so giving it all back, is that significant in your view?
It's not too significant, Carol. As you know, and you all talk about so often, there's just really a few names that have been the major driver for the direction of the S&P all year. Just really seven names really pushing for the almost all of the returns. And so what I find much more interesting is digging below and looking at what the stocks underneath those seven are doing and the direction of those stocks.
So what do you see when you do that? I mean, you take out the big mega cap tech gainers. What's the rest of the market doing?
Yeah, I think, Matt, it's a really interesting question, because most people would assume what you find there is just all underperformers. And generally, in aggregate, yes, that's the answer. But when you look company by company, you see a lot more dispersion. You see companies that are really some that are really outperforming given the volatile environment we have, and some that are underperforming pretty massively. But what I like is, for the most part, company fundamentals are driving performance. And you're not seeing that necessarily just, you know, on the top side of the market with those tech names. You are seeing it as you dig deeper below. And so it makes it really interesting for active managers here and for people who want to spend the time focusing on fundamentals and stock selection.
So where do you look, though? Because there's obviously, we spend, and as you know, a lot of times talking about the large cap names, those S&P 500. Yeah. There's so much that goes on when we talk with guests. I feel like I felt that when we were out at Milken about the mid cap space. And then, of course, we also look at the small cap space, great indicator of kind of the broader U.S. economy. Where do you find the most interesting moves and the best opportunities?
Well, when I'm talking to our investment teams right now, what they tell me is the significant underperformance on an aggregate basis, again, across the small and mid-cap companies, that's where they're finding much more opportunity. And so although they might hold some of those large cap names that you talk about every day, they're not, you know, necessarily adding to those. That's not an attractive place to add. They're much more expensive. Small cap stocks, the Russell 2000, has underperformed the Russell 3000 five consecutive years. and 9 of the last 11. And so, you know, do any of us know when that's going to turn? No, but what we do know is historically that's kind of unbelievable in terms of what history would suggest. And we also know that when you're coming out of an inflationary time period, once you're out of a slower economy and you start to see a pickup, which I know we have a little bit to go here, small cap companies can outgrow and grow at a faster pace. And so, you know, I know you asked me a very specific question, Carol, and I don't want to escape it. I think what we're seeing is across the board, across industries, company by company, when you're out there looking, there's some very attractive names, whether that's in healthcare, whether that's in technology, just down cap, whether that's in industrials. There are companies that have good cash flow, good balance sheets, and management teams that have lived through a lot of uncertain times in the past. And they're the companies that are managing through this time period really well.
And what do you say to the investor who says, listen, I don't want to take that much risk, and I'm already getting, you know, for the first time in forever, 5-6% out of very safe fixed income investments. Is fixed income a big, you know, competitor to the equity investments that you want to make?
I do think fixed income is back, and our fixed income team is really doing a great job trying to add alpha on top of where, you know, yields are going. But remember, most investors are looking for a diversified investment view. And for the equity portion, I mean, you started off the show by saying, you know, a lot of the old theory, sell in May and go away. If any investors do that, even if it's outside of May, you got to be right twice. You got to be right on the sale and you got to be right on the return. And so I don't think now is the time to leave equities, because, you know, it still is a great place over history. Time would suggest it's still the place where you're going to gain the greatest return.
But where would you park if you're looking to, if we get what some say is a downturn in the equity side of things, and where do you kind of park to maybe just even maintain your gains at this point?
Yeah, that's the most important question, Carol. And I do think we are headed into a softer economy as we enter the back half of the year and maybe even into early 2024. So I see that our investment teams are being much more disciplined, much more focused on investing in quality companies, looking for companies that are trading at a discount, which is why we see them going more down cap. They are looking in areas of the market that have underperformed and industries that have underperformed, but again, looking for stronger fundamentals. Dividend paying companies still are important. And more importantly, though, are companies that have a dividend and can continue to pay that dividend. I would also say, you know, the emerging market space is an area that I haven't talked about a lot in the last couple of years, but an area that, you know, could potentially show, I think, good returns in the next couple of years. Many emerging markets have already seen peak rates and are starting to take rates down. They're a little bit ahead of the U.S. And so as I talk to a lot of our emerging markets teams, That's another area.
All right. Well, good to get some time with you. Anne, thanks. Be well. Anne Mulledy, she's head of active equity, over at Allspring Global Investments on Zoom from Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. I was just looking at the Schwab Dividend Equity Index ETF, and it is down about 6% so far this year. But I've heard a lot of people, folks, come out and say dividends, that's the way to go.
Yeah, well, they're piling into the short treasuries, piling into money markets. You know, people always say cash on the sidelines, right?
Yeah.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons. This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.